I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, rock star. It's gender neutral. The term can apply to women as well as men. But a male rock star isn't interchangeable with a woman rock star. There's something special, intangible, a distinct polymorphic energy that is brought to the stage when a woman decides she's going to rock. Aretha Franklin, Tina Turner, Grace Slick, Janis Joplin, Stevie Nicks, Chrissy Hynde, Joan Jett, so many others. They fought their way to the top of the world of rock with talent, grit, and an authentic point of view that has entertained, inspired, and informed generations. Award-winning radio personality Meredith Ox takes an insightful look at 50 female rock icons who kicked it hard and left their boot prints on the world of rock and roll. Her book is Rock and Roll Woman, the 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Today we're talking about the book Rock and Roll Woman, the 50 Fiercest Female Rockers with author Meredith Ox. This is Patti Smith. Rock and Roll Woman, the 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. Fiercest is the thing that sticks out at me. Why did you come up with that adjective? Why is that important?
That word has really taken on new sort of meaning in vernacular. But in terms of the book, it's an attitude. A lot of these women really had to fight their way into the music industry. And to be fierce was to be able to stand up to people who were constantly saying, no, you can't do that for whatever reason. You can't play guitar. Or I think back to like being in marching band when I was a little kid and you can't play drums. You're a girl. So it's an attitude. And each of the 50 artists, and it was very hard to come up with 50. I mean, it was hard to narrow it down to 50 rather, because there's so many, but each of them had that thing, that fight in them that made them not give up and enabled them to be wildly successful.
So when you say they were fierce, do you mean in their stage persona, in the challenging of social norms? Because a rock and roll star is a person, their job is to hold up the middle finger to the world and expectations, assumptions, everything that's been put upon us. And then it's also being fierce as in, I'm going to claim my space on this stage, and then also I'm going to stand up to a industry that's very male, and women typically who have been part of it have maybe have been more as garnish or but not really the ones who called the shots.
For all of those things, right? I mean, fierceness on stage, you think of Riot Girl, some of those bands. Kathleen Hanna was fierce on stage. Then you think of someone like Linda Ronstadt, who's also in the book, who you wouldn't think of her as fierce on stage, but to cover Tumble and Dice and Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me and these very sort of macho songs written by guys, sung by guys, That's fierce. Carole King, you never think of her as being fierce. But to be 15 years old and take the subway from Brooklyn to Times Square and go up to the titans of the music industry, and as a 15-year-old, my goodness, I can't even imagine. But that's fierce too. So yeah, all of from the very beginning of people telling them no, you can't do this, to being on stage and creating some sort of persona.
Linda Ronstadt also being fierce in claiming her Latina roots.
That as well. Yeah, wait, she was, I don't want to say ahead of the curve, but before it became a thing to embrace whoever it was that you were, the music industry sought more homogenous artists, and she was like, no, this is who I am. La fiesta charra, fiesta del sol. Donde los charros valientes dan con sus cantos la evocación. El jaripeo es un festejo que huele a surco y a tradición. Rueneado de la faena más admirada de mi nación. Bonito es el jaripeo y cuando es su animación. Yo quiero montarle un toro para que me mire mi amor. Upali 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 upali. Yo quiero montarle un toro para que me mire mi amor. I knew I wanted to start with Rosetta Tharpe, who in the middle of writing the book, she's inducted into the Rock Hall of Fame. In the fall of 2017, they announced she was going to be in the class of 2018. So I was excited about that. I knew I wanted to start with her because she's so much the foundation of rock and roll. And the guys we often credit with inventing rock and roll, many of them were deeply influenced by her. And I knew I wanted to end with Brittany Howard of the Alabama Shakes, who it seems to me that that's just full circle. She didn't grow up knowing who Sister Rosetta Tharpe was, but when she did, she clearly took on so many of her attributes and the things that she did on stage, even the guitar she played. So those were, I knew I had a start and an end. And then I just wanted to build this arc of fierce women, of rock and roll, artists who had a major impact on rock. You know, you could argue for or against some of them and say, oh, she's more R&B, she's a country artist, but they had the major part of their career was a big impact on rock music.
They don't know where in the devil they're at, and that's all.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe, a guitar playing style. Was there really no one else like her before her?
If there was, I couldn't find her. I mean, think about it. She started in the 30s, and even electric guitar was new in the 30s. I mean, it was it didn't become a consumer item until then. So she was one of the earliest to pick up that guitar. And it just so happened that the church that she was singing in, that her family was so deeply connected to, they had electric guitar in church. Aretha Franklin's church, she also came from that world. They didn't have that. Baptist Church had piano. But these other, the Church of God in Christ, they had like full bands sometimes. So she's in the right place at the right time. But yeah, think about it. Even the instrument itself was kind of new back then.
And she had this command of it that as good as anyone in the industry today.
Oh, amazing. I mean, she practiced her scales, I guess, like what no young guitar player wants to hear. Practice your scales, learn this, learn that. But she had a natural feel for how to make it wail. I mean, she invented something that wasn't there before. It came from all these different parts of what she had grown up with, especially gospel, obviously. But then when she moves to New York and starts playing at the Cotton Club, it evolves into something else, and that's all her.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Now up above my head.
Up above my head.
You know I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
And I really do believe.
Yes, I really do believe that
there's a heaven somewhere. Heaven somewhere.
There was all this appropriation, cultural appropriation happening in the early days of rock and roll. And one of them, Elvis Presley was part of that as well. And he was able to be inspired by the song Hound Dog and make that a massive hit for himself. But he wasn't the first to sing that song.
Correct. It was first sung by Big Mama Thornton. And it was written for Big Mama Thornton, who is chapter 2 of the book. I also insisted that she be in the book. And Willie Mae Thornton, if you live in New York City and you've sent your daughter to Willie Mae's Rock Camp for Girls, that's Big Mama Thornton's name, Willie Mae Thornton. So yeah, so that's also a really interesting question about appropriation, because Elvis did have so much love for Black music, for blues, for gospel, for R&B, and he did turn it into something else, something that was marketable and palatable for a more mainstream audience. But sure, that song Hound Dog, written for Big Mama Thornton by Lee Byrne Stoller.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, been snooping on the door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, been snooping on the door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you.
I love the story of that song, because these two young 19-year-old songwriters, who of course went on to become huge and are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Big Mama Thornton is not, they meet Willie Mae, and she is utterly terrifying. She's over 6 feet tall. Her face is all scarred up. She's dressed like a man. She must have scared the living whatever out of them. But they love her. They're fascinated by her. And that day, they write Hound Dog for her. And she records it, and that's the first version of the song.
In your book, you talk about the influences, the influenced, and the deep cuts. And the deep cuts kind of help us go deeper than the songs that we may instinctively know, you know, that we've been programmed by our top 40 radio, Casey Kasem, consumption over the years. But then you talk about the influences, and these are two women who come up a lot in your book, Big Mama Thornton and Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Well, sure. I mean, the influenced and influences section was also just my way of cramming more very, very worthy artists into a book with only 50 chapters. So that there was that element of it. But I also was looking for the narrative threads that connected these women. I wanted something that spanned decades and spanned genres. I wanted mainstream artists in there. I wanted indie or little-known artists in there. And the influences kind of lets you see how these artists influenced one another, like back and forth on the timeline of music.
In this timeline of music that you have in the book, you see really also the change of the role of women in society, that they are able to claim a more self-owning role in our society, in inner music, in self-expression. And so in a way, the development of women in rock is reflective of what we've been over the last 50 years.
Right. And a lot of these women, they pushed that. They were leaders on that. They did things before it was acceptable. I even hate to use that word, but they definitely, as artists should push the culture, they certainly did. And that goes through from the 1930s with Rosetta Tharpe through the 90s and Riot Girl, all the way up to now. We're not really where we should be quite yet.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about women and rock and roll. This is the band Bikini Kill. The song is Rebel Girl. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm talking about the book Rock and Roll Woman, the 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. I'm joined by the author, Meredith Ox. This is Ronnie Spector with the Ronettes in 1964 asking, "Do I love you?" So who would you think would be somebody who really just kicked that door down, the hardest?
Oh, wow. That's a tough question because so many of them did. But you first think of Tina Turner and Ronnie Spector. They were both married to musical geniuses. I mean, I got to give it up for Ike Turner and Phil Spector. They may have been and still are horrible human beings, but they're geniuses musically and had also had a big impact on rock. And they, as couples, each of them are drawn to each other, I think, in part because they're all so talented. But those women were told, you don't leave your husband, you stay, you work it out, even if he's doing horrible things.
Like physical
And
abuse.
eventually, yeah, oh, just appalling physical abuse, mental abuse. I mean, Phil Spector took away Ronnie's shoes. She couldn't leave her house. He had her followed. It was living there was a nightmare. She was supposed to go on tour with the Beatles. Here she is. She's famous. She's finally achieved this dream of hers, and he takes it away. Phil Spector. He pulls it away, and he puts her cousin on tour with the Ronettes to go tour Europe, and he locks her in his mansion. There's the physical abuse, of course, and the two of them. I mean, I'm not trying to lump them together, but they each have their own story. But yes, eventually they both leave. But the reason, you say, why did they stay so long? Tina Turner stayed with Ike for 17 years because that was proper. You're supposed to stay with your husband. But eventually she gets out.
Oh, there's something on my mind. Won't somebody please, please tell me what's wrong?
There's so much love these days for Ronnie Spector in the business.
I've interviewed her so many times. She is just one of the loveliest people. On stage, she's still incredible. She's got that voice. And I think I write about this in the book. There may be three people with that teardrop in their voice. There's Linda Ronstadt has it, Patsy Cline had it, and Ronnie Spector has it.
Rock star and a female rock star, they are not interchangeable parts. That their gender is a part of what they bring with.
I've been like asking myself how to parse that for many years. Like it's an interesting question. What do women bring to the stage that's different? What do they bring to songwriting that's different? Is it different? Probably. I mean, when you listen to the lyrics of a lot of the artists in the book, a lot of them are more, I don't want to say more personal. I don't know. But I think there is something to that question.
Yeah,
and
so
I don't even know if it's answerable.
Well, let me think about it this way. You know, so Otis Redding wrote the song Respect. And his version, so much different than the one that Aretha Franklin did. His is about coming home, and he's tired, he's late at work, and he's got to give his money to his woman, and all he's asking for is a little respect. And then it was an okay song for him, But then Aretha Franklin took the song, and boy, did she turn it all around and turn it into an anthem with so much. Of course, her singing ability is fantastic, but it was so much there about her demanding respect that only a woman could have taken that song and done that with it.
When Aretha recorded the song, to her, it was just a relationship song. She said that many times throughout her career. I was not speaking to all these heavy issues that were attached to the song. I was just talking about boy-girl stuff. So there's part of it is that Aretha was a genius music arranger, and she never got credit until the early 70s when she made her double live gospel album Amazing Grace. It's the first time she gets a credit on an album for arrangements, but she rearranged Respect, and that also is what made it a hit. You know, her and her sisters putting the Socket to Me in there, that too. So, and that was just, again, vernacular. It was just what was being said around. They thought it was funny. So There's it's the time and place, and also like the brilliance of Aretha's arrangement that make that song as powerful and as enduring as it is.
Yet there was something there that generations of people have listened to, and it spoke to them, talking about respect. It was not just a song that she rearranged and she performed. She was bringing things about her existence, her female point of view to the story.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, you know, she's in this marriage at that time with Ted White, and also she's finding herself as an independent person, because she divorced him shortly thereafter. She's finding herself, her footing as a woman in business, as a woman in, you know, in a marriage or out of marriage. So I absolutely agree with you. And that's also why it endures as a feminist anthem, because it's a fight that continues. You know, as I said earlier, we're not really there yet. And so that song definitely speaks to the struggle. And that's why we're still talking about it. And that's why it still resonates.
As anyone who's going to perform as a rock star, whatever, where you are on the gender spectrum, that's all going to come out. And it seems there's all sorts of different shades of femininity and how that is part of each one of these 50 that you have here. And it's all part of who they are.
And it manifests in so many different ways too, which really interested me in researching the book. And also as a fan of these women, Susie Quattro, for example, a very feminine person, and yet she projected this very gender-neutral image. And
but she seemed like a tough guy, almost.
Exactly, right. But really, she's like this like, you know, sweet, kind of gentle soul, and she gets married and stays married for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. The first time then she gets divorced, she gets married again and is still married to the same guy. All these years later, she's living in this English country manse where she raises her kids. So she's like a family person. She's traditional. And she also, when you speak with her, she projects a very kind of feminine self. So it always kind of, it's interesting that when she became a rock star, the image she wanted to have on stage was the antithesis of that. And I think part of it is that she's with all these bands that are glitter rock, glam rock. She's with Sweet and Slade and these guys who are wearing like 5-inch heels and glitter makeup and stuff. So in a way, maybe she did it to stand out amongst the guys who were trying to look like girls. I don't know.
You broke my heart when you come home with somebody else's lipstick on. Without me. Oh, it's me, the fool who's always there, and you're the fool who never cares. And then I get it. And I nail my mouth to the evil taste of lipstick. Inhale the scent of someone else's lipstick. Someone else's lipstick. Someone else's lipstick.
Male rock stars, they are projecting, no matter who it is a maleness also, you know, a masculinity, sometimes
true.
A toxic masculinity.
yes.
And sometimes a very sweet and enduring one. You never know. So to say that, oh, we're examining the femininity of these women is because it is who they are. And then it's part of their rock persona. So, I mean, you've been in bands, you're in the public eye, you understand that you have to package up who it is that you present, right?
Yes, that's
you know,
true.
Do you think that all of these women, or most of them, have went through a process to figure out, this is who I'm going to present as, I am a woman rocker, and this is who I am?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that a lot of it evolved naturally through their specific interests. For example, Exene Cervenka of X, she loves collecting old vintage stuff. She has this heavy religious upbringing, and that works its way into her image. She loves poetry. That works its way into her image. And so in taking into account, and I guess you see kids do this when you, I have nieces, they're 12 and 14 now, and watching them sort of craft their own image out of their interests, whether it's Harry Potter or emo. It's really interesting to me because that's what all these women do. And so a lot of fans think they just rolled out of bed looking like that, you know, but no, it takes years to figure out who it is you're going to present yourself as a performer.
And of course, it's not a fiction. It is a representation of this individual on stage as a performer. There's a reality,
right,
a truth. It is a truth.
Right. And so for most people, if you go to a job, like a office job, you have to assume the suit. You have to assume the look that's expected of you. For an artist, you can look however you like. So you're really just wearing all your interests on the outside when you choose this as a career.
So like Karen O from Yeah Yeah Yeahs.
Off with your head. Dance till you're dead. Heather roll, on the floor. Glitter on the wet streets. Silver over everything. The river's all wet. You're all cold. Dripping with alchemy. Shiver, stop shivering. The glitter's all wet.
Karen O, she always felt like she stood out because she is, she grows up in the suburbs of New Jersey and she just feels like an oddball. And then she goes to college, I think she goes to Oberlin, which is where that attracts a lot of folks who feel like that. And then all of a sudden she's lost in this sea of oddballs. And she moves to the East Village, New York in the 90s, which again is a place that attracts people who are looking for, I mean, all kinds of people, but specifically artists who are looking to express themselves. And then she meets this designer who helps her kind of craft this very fashion-oriented image. And she's really tall and really thin, and stuff looks good on her that wouldn't look good on anybody. So yeah, again, it's like who she is inside. It's her interests, and that all goes into creating this person who you see on stage.
Let's go to break with another song from one of the 50 fiercest female rock stars profiled in the book Rock and Roll Woman. Here is Joan Jett, back when she was with the Runaways and wrote the song Cherry Bomb. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm chatting it up with Meredith Ox, author of the book Rock and Roll Woman, The 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. This is the Go-Go's. They're singing This Town. Is there a lot of hostility that these women have to confront in order to reach the success that they've achieved?
Hostility, like industry or public or both, all?
From grandma on down, you know?
Well, yes. I mean, some had more supportive families than others for it starting out, right? Some had the hostility of the crowd. I mean, even the Go-Go's, for example, they're Los Angeles all-girl band. They go to England and they play on the punk scene. And the punks were spitting on everyone back then, but they especially spit on the Go-Go's. So yeah, I would call that hostility. And they do that for a really long time, and it's horrible, and they hate it. But they know they're like making their bones. They're like, they want this, and so they're willing to put up with it. You have Pat Benatar, who had hostility from the industry. She had people at her own record label telling her, "You're never going to sell out an arena." So she goes on her first tour, and when she comes back, she has sold out her hometown arena, Madison Square Garden.
What did they think was wrong with her that she couldn't sell out an arena? I mean, she had the pipes.
I hate to try to climb inside the mind of a music industry executive, especially one in the 1980s. But I think that they didn't think she was rock and roll enough because she came from this classical music background. And she was going to go to Juilliard and study opera. She was like on her way. And then she gets sidetracked actually by Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones. She falls in love with rock. She meets Neil Giraldo, a guitar player who becomes her husband, and they're still together like 40 years later. And she decides, I can do this, and she does it. But I think there was some of that. There was some of that she was just tiny and not diminutive, but she was like physically small. I think that, I'm not exactly sure what the calculus was, but I suspect that they thought, oh, this little girl who has an opera voice, she's never going to be able to do this. She's never going to have a big rock career. And she really showed them.
Was there a look You had to have a certain look. This is according to the executives in their big offices and their long lunches. And they just assumed that, oh, you don't fit our idea of what it takes in order to sell records.
I think that there always has been a look, and we could talk about that as a separate issue. But back then, it was definitely a gender thing, because you hear both Pat Benatar and Melissa Etheridge and other women in the book, as they're trying to get their music played on the radio, program directors are saying, oh, we have one woman on the playlist. We don't need another. And that's something that really resonates as a woman in business. You hear that too. You hear that everywhere. Oh, we have one woman on the team. We don't need two. We have one woman as a DJ. We don't need two. And it's a sad thing, but you still hear that.
It didn't stop Fleetwood Mac.
Well, that's true. But, you know, they did Fleetwood Mac, the blues band, as it evolved into Fleetwood Mac, the sort of adult rock band, after the two founders left the band and the rest of the guys asked Christine McVie before they brought Stevie Nicks in. You know, Lindsey Buckingham they wanted, but Lindsey said, I'm not coming without my girlfriend. So they said, well, let's ask Christine. She's the only girl in the band. Before we bring in Stevie Nicks, we better make sure they get along. And so they really left it to Christine McVie to decide. Fortunately, she and Stevie Nicks get along great. They're totally different. Stevie is this like West Coast hippie-ish, hyper feminine, Wiccan like twirling woman, and Christine McVie is this like British taciturn, funny but quiet English Rose, and they hit it off, and they navigate the world of rock and roll together, and they realize that they're stronger together, and then they end up outshining their former partners. Although, you know, Lindsey Buckingham, great guitar player, wrote some hits, but really, the two women in Fleetwood Mac are the ones who wrote most of the big hits.
Let's go to break with some Fleetwood Mac. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, Rock and Roll Woman, the 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. That's the name of the book. Meredith Ox is the author. We're going to be right back.
So I'm back to the velvet.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about the book Rock and Roll Woman. In the list of the 50 fiercest female rockers, there is Chrissie Hynde.
Now the reason we're here as man and woman is to love each other, take care of each other. When love walks in the room, everybody stand up. Oh, it's good, good, good. Like Brigitte Bardot.
When it comes to talking about conventions and people who don't follow them and people who are able to live life on their own terms, Chrissie Hynde just does that.
She is one of the most remarkable people in rock and roll. I mean, you think about her journey from, she grows up in Akron, Ohio, she goes to Kent State. All she wants to do is move to England. Like many of us who love music, we were teenage Anglophiles, right? She actually ups and does it. She moves to London. She starts writing for the NME as a journalist. She interviews, of all people, Susie Quattro. They form a friendship. And Chrissie Hynde kind of builds this network of friends, specifically women friends, which is interesting because when she finally forms her band, it's guys. And she, I think, has mostly played with guys. But even to this day, she tours with women. She has these great friendships with women. But starting out, she encourages Viv Albertine to join the Slits. Viv encourages her. You see, like, these women influencing each other in really positive ways and encouraging each other. But yeah, Chrissie Hynde, I mean, she sounds like no one else. She wrote like no one else. Her band didn't sound like anyone else's. I still think that first Pretenders album is just, it's one of the greatest rock debuts, if not one of the greatest rock albums of all time.
But the songs that she wrote, while they're delicious to listen to, they're also very weighted. As a woman, what she expected of a man, which I thought was interesting, which you didn't hear a lot of that.
Oh, I've never heard anything like it. And I remember listening to those songs as a girl and thinking, this is terrifying. I'd never heard a woman express herself like that and be so bold and so strong that was just something that she could handle.
Don't get me wrong. If I'm looking kind of dazzled, I see neon lights. Whenever you walk by, don't get me wrong. You say hello and I take a ride.
When there's a woman on stage rocking in this fierce manner, they're really doing something very important in terms of defining space for other women. And these other women, they're not going to be rock stars, but they will be the rock stars in their own home or in their own lives. And they have to, and when to have other people creating new paradigms and icons that they can use as role models or someone to inspire them, that's important.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think you see contemporary women artists playing with image, like St. Vincent, who has also, much like Debbie Harry, her whole persona is sort of an art project. You see young rock and rollers like Beth Ditto, who just... They are just themselves, and they decide, you know, I'm gonna project this, and I don't care what you think. This is who I am. And then I wonder about other, you know, more up and coming people whose names we haven't heard yet, like how they feel they need to craft this image for themselves. I'm thinking about the Screaming Females, which is a band from New Jersey who are starting to kind of pick up steam. And their guitar player, who doesn't wear makeup, and she's kind of reminds me of the 90s, where the band would get up and walk on stage, and before that you didn't know who the band was and who the fans were and who the roadies were.
Do women as a whole look to fierce rock and roll stars, women rock and roll stars, as someone to help them navigate the complexities of life?
I hope that's true. Like, I hope that young women can look at some of the women in the book and get that message. You know, when I was growing up and I loved rock and roll music and I would read all about these women, I knew I wasn't going to be them. I couldn't or be them, or I didn't have some of the same attitudes or whatever it was that they had. But they inspired me to, they made me know that I could be whatever I wanted to. And I just, it sounds like a very simplistic message, but I hope that young women do gather at least some confidence from reading about these women who did stuff in an era where it just wasn't done.
We've been talking with Meredith Ox. She wrote the book Rock and Roll Woman, 50 Fiercest Female Rockers. I'm David Martin Davies. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're going out with Screaming Females, Normal.
I keep you.